Good evening, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our live show, dated the 18th of June 2019. I should say today or this evening or something. Great to have you all on board and welcome to the latest discussion in our series, which I think is pretty important at the moment. There's a lot going on and we've got a lot to get through tonight. So we've already gone through in the pre-show some intros. There's a lot of people on already. Great to see you all. And thank you very much for those who are using the Super Chat. Really appreciate it. It is really great to see some of the comments there. I will do some more acknowledgements a little bit later. But James F. just does say thank you so much for that. Really appreciate it. And you get your very own today. That's great. Thank you for that. Okay, so what we're going to do now is we're just going to go through the first part of the show, which will be, as normal, about 10, 15 minutes max of me just going through some slides. There's a lot of information came out today, which you may not be across yet. I want to make sure you are. And then we will go into detailed discussions. We'll also be taking questions as we go through. But just to say, at the moment, I won't be looking at the chat. So if you want to use Super Chat and those things, don't necessarily assume I'm going to see it. Fact of the matter is, there's a lot to get through, and the best way to do it is for me to just go through the slides first. So here we go. And I think the first thing to say is that as we look at the situation today, you know, there is a lot going on, but just to sort of give you a bit of a sense of what we're going to do, we're going to just quickly go through our running order, our introduction, done that, the house rules, we'll cover those briefly, about our models, very important for you to understand how we do what we do. A few key slides, then the questions and answers. The bulk of the show tonight will be Q&A. I do have a bunch of questions that people sent me through earlier on, and hopefully we'll get to some of those, but of course I'll prioritise on those on the live stream. And then we'll do a sign-off, probably about an hour and a half, plus or minus a little bit. And let's see how we go. So in terms of house rules, please note this is not financial advice. I'm not allowed to give financial advice. I don't know your personal circumstances. This is my general opinions based on my research, quite extensive research, but please don't take this as financial advice. A few people have grizzled because they're claiming I said X and, you know, Y's happened. Well, you know, this is just my opinion, so take it or leave it, but please, it's not financial advice. I'm not able, I'm not willing, cannot give it. Please play nice in the chat room, no racial slurs. We have had in the past a few people get a little bit difficult. The fact of the matter is that whole point here is that this is a really intelligent community and we have a lot of really good discussions, not only the discussions that I'm facilitating here, but also on the chat amongst the various members of the community. So if we get lots of rubbish in the chat, then it just devalues everything. So please, please, please do play nice. We are moderating, and if necessary, we will take steps if we need to. This is, of course, as at the 18th of June 2019. It is, we'll know in a few months' time whether my forecasts are right or wrong or different, but things change, unfortunately. That's just the way. Use Walk the World, at Walk the World, to get my attention. There are so many things going on the chat. I don't really have a chance to look at every single conversation, but if you've got Walk the World, there's a really good chance. And of course, you can use Super Chat. That's now enabled. And that just basically means that you can pay for attention. You'll get recognized and your message will stay at the top of the chat for as long as you actually want it to. So that's something which we enabled last time. And the good news is that a number of people found that very helpful. So that's why we're doing it again. Okay, just in terms of the core model, you may have seen this if you've been following DFA for some time, but we survey households, 52,000 households. We suck information from all sources, RBA, APRA, ABS, trading information. We pull that into our core market model. The core market model is our fundamental analytics. Want to be economists today? Thank you very much. Really appreciate that. Thank you. And then what we do is we use that to generate a series of reports, feeds the blog, feeds the YouTube channel, and basically enables us to do what we do. So that's the way it works. And of course, we're able to slice and dice the data lots of different ways. And what that means is that essentially we can look at trends, we can look at different behaviours going on, and begin to look at the fact that different households may be doing different things. Because what you will discover as you work with me is that, in fact, averaging masks, you've got to get granular to really know what is going on. And now some data, just to sort of get the juices flowing. So this is essentially the latest unemployment data. This is from Westpac, this particular chart. And one of the really interesting things about this is that the underemployment's now at 8.6%. That's higher than when we were in the GFC. Post-GFC, we've got 7.5%. We have more people underemployed, so other, in other words, not doing enough the work they wanted, as much work as they wanted to work. And what that basically means is that we have a lot of people who are finding it quite difficult to get the sort of employment that they want, as well as unemployment, of course, lifting to 5.2. TJ Jingulk, thank you very much. Really appreciate that today. You've got your own today now. Thank you. So unemployment's pretty high and rising. And one of the interesting questions, of course, for everybody is that going to continue? Because, of course, the RBA is essentially saying that the likelihood is that unemployment needs to get to 4.5% before we actually see full employment and before we really see anything in the way of wages growth, which is, of course, remarkable. And we'll come on to that in a second. RBA minutes came out today. They basically talked about lower interest rates. That will help effectively households pay their debts, you know, the sort of normal stuff. Overall net effect of lower interest rates expect to boost aggregate household disposable income. So this is all about making households effectively work harder and spend more, but we'll see. Second is they've said that the changes to APRA will increase borrowing capacity for those on lower interest rate loans, but those with perhaps higher incomes or bigger loans will have significantly less additional capacity. So they are admitting some change, but not necessarily big change. And then this is the really important point. Given the amount of spare capacity in the labour market, members agree that it's likely that there will be further easing in monetary policy. And the issue there is that low interest rates, they say, it won't necessarily be the only policy option. There may be others. Jay Bree, today, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Okay, so let's just go on with our slides. So the point there is we now know that there are more rate cuts and other strategies being considered by the Reserve Bank. So, and we've talked about that over the last few days, quantitative easing and other bits and pieces. Okay, now, of course, the RBA is expecting an income bounce. So this is from one of their charts. And basically, we're saying that income, disposable income growth is sitting at 2%. They think it's going to go to 4% quite soon. Frankly, I think that's extremely unlikely. And the fact of the matter is, like it or not, I don't see how they're going to be able to make that work. So my view is that income is going to probably not grow anything like as fast as perhaps people would hope that it might. The next one, of course, is housing credit is still slowing in terms of the rate of credit growth going down. Look at owner-occupied and investment loans. But I also want to highlight the broad money. Broad money is rising, and there is quite a lot of evidence now that the Reserve Bank is actually, through its repo program, effectively already doing QE. What they're doing is basically putting more money into the system to drive interest rates down. And that's one of the reasons why, in a moment, you'll see that the BBSW rate is down. But credit momentum has not yet really taken up, despite the recent rate cuts and everything else. So there's some interesting to see what happens ahead, I guess. There was a small election bounce in terms of confidence. We discussed this in one of our posts. Very small, particularly those with mortgages, and that's because rates potentially are going to drop a little bit. But what's interesting is that the free affluence, those with property but no mortgages, hardly bounced at all, which I thought was quite interesting. So we'll see that how it goes. It's early days. It may well be that overall momentum post the election is a lot lower than people actually thought. We'll see. Okay, let's now go on to talk about the RBA's speech. So there was a meeting today at which Jonathan Kearns, who's the head of financial stability at RBA, spoke about rising house arrears. And he basically said arrears aren't too bad. They're higher than they have been, but not as high as they were when we were in recession back in 1990s. But my point is, we're not in recession, and yet he's basically saying that the default rates are actually rising. And he concludes that doesn't so far present a risk to financial stability, but of course he does recognise that individual borrowers have been hit. My argument is arrears are actually very much problematic, and if you want to sort of see that, look at the next slide. So this is the latest spin. This came out today. Well, actually yesterday, but I published it today. So SPIN, this is the mortgage-backed security default rates from Standard & Poor's, and you can see it's gone up again, up in Western Australia into 3.1%, Northern Territory is up to 3.3%, Queensland is up as well to 1.94%, and New South Wales and Victoria are all up. So apart from ACT, who's down a bit, everybody else is up. And the other point to make is that the major banks and regional banks are reporting a rise in longer term delinquencies, particularly regional banks are reporting 90-day plus arrears rising. So we are in a situation where interest rates are ultra low, where we've got relatively full employment, and yet the fact of the matter is that default rates are rising, and there's a correlation between what's happening now and mortgage stress, because I was watching mortgage stress build over the last 2 or 3 years in Western Australia, and now we're seeing it correlated in terms of defaults. So there's a lag of 2 or 3 years, but it tends to follow. And by the way, that means defaults will be higher ahead. And thus on that, mortgage stress, 31.7%, well over a million households in stress now. Household debt, of course, is very high relative to income. We know that. It's grown. And what I'll be now looking to see is whether, in fact, mortgage stress, which is a cash flow based analysis, basically money in, money out, is going to ease back if in fact rates are cut and we get the tax breaks and tax cuts and those things coming through. But at the moment, there's absolutely no evidence of anything happening to reduce mortgage stress, so defaults will continue to rise. BBSW is way down. This is a remarkable slide. So the bank bill swap rate is effectively the bank trading rate for Australian banks. And we used to follow it up from its lows back more than a year ago, up sort of 20 to 25 basis points higher, which we were then saying put a lot of pressure on bank margins. But now in the last few weeks, you can see that it's come really right the way down from sort of February, March time. And we are now minus 46 basis points. Glenys, today, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. That's great. Thank you for your help. Really appreciate it. 46.5 basis points. That's pretty amazing. And what that means is that banks, in theory, have some potential to pass on margin if they chose to. Not that they might, not that they will, because, of course, they're managing margins and other things. H-Man, thank you very much. Appreciate that today. You get your very own today. So that's the point. We're seeing quite a lot of issues there in terms of funding costs, and it'll be interesting to see whether any of that gets passed through. Depositors, of course, are being taken to the cleaners. Prices are still falling in most centres. This is actually the ABS data published today, and it showed that basically in the last year, prices have fallen by 10.3% in Sydney, 9.4% in Melbourne, Adelaide's 0.8%, Hobart's 4.6%, and the only capital cities recording positive for the year. So basically those last two were positive, everybody else going down. And all capital cities recorded a property prices fall in the March quarter. So the other point to make is that the total value of property is falling. And we've lost $172 billion worth of value from our property portfolios to $6.6 trillion in the March quarter. So talk about the wealth effect or the negative wealth effect, you can really see that coming through. I'll probably do a more detailed post later on this. The other point to make is that the settlements are way down. So we think settlements, in other words, the number of properties transferred are down but nearly 30%. So we know that essentially there are some issues ahead. Now, of course, everyone's talking the market up, but the question is that true or not? Is it likely to happen? Okay, and here's a few for specific examples, because I keep saying that averages mask, and that's the point really. 10% down in Sydney is really not telling the whole story. So I've just picked a few. North Ryde units down 31.2% from peak over the last year. 31.2% over the last year. That's remarkable. Hurstville houses down 17.3% over the last year. And Paddington, right close into city, down units 14.7%. Max, thank you very much today. Appreciate it. Thank you so much. The point here is, yeah, there are some areas where prices are stabilizing or going up, but there's a whole lot of places where prices are continuing to slide. And what that basically means is that we have essentially to understand that this is not a simple thing, right? There's no try. Have you tried a volume chart for the BBSW? Yeah, the answer is yes and no. It's quite hard to get really good volume data on the BBSW in time to do that. And I'll answer some of the other questions that I see there shortly. But there we go, some specific examples. But just to make the point, there are postcodes in Western Sydney and in Western Australia where prices are down well over 30% now. People are in negative equity, and that's a big deal. Okay, just quickly going on to then to us. Oh, this is one that John Adam sent me. We spoke yesterday on both the Interests of the People channel and DFA on the Mascot Tower situation. John sent me this today from somebody who's basically shown me as another picture of a commercial building in southwestern Sydney, which basically has more defects. This building's defects thing is significant, important, and wide-ranging, and could fundamentally pull prices lower, in my view. So I think that's quite interesting. And if you go over to John on Twitter, you can follow the conversations around this, because there's been quite a lot of conversations. I've got a few other pictures now coming through from other people as well. This is a widespread problem. Poor construction over the last 10 to 15 years is really coming home to roost. Okay. Now, just quickly on our scenarios, there have been some significant changes this time around in the scenarios, and I just want to spend a little bit of time showing you some of those. They're just a way of thinking about alternative futures, right? So I'm not necessarily saying that X or Y is going to happen. We look at it through a number of different lenses. The business as usual, RBA, you know, everything the RBA says works, what would happen? Things can only get better, not yet doomsday. Armageddon, which isn't sort of equivalent to Ireland, and doomsday equivalent to Iceland. And what we tried to do is to tell you some things about each of those and also weight the probabilities. And those who have been following for some time will know that we had a very strong view around not yet doomsday being the most likely scenario by quite a lot over the last couple of months. But things have changed. So the first thing to say is that the business as usual now is fundamentally different because the RBA has fundamentally changed its tune. So it's now forecasting lower interest rates, multiple rate cuts, and it's forecasting unemployment rate of 4.5%. If that were to happen, we think mortgage stress would drop to about 30%. We think the bank losses will be about 2.9 basis points. And home prices in this scenario, if everything played out over the next 2 to 3 years, could be up somewhere between 5 and 8% on average. And there's easing credit and there's quantitative easing in this scenario. And the probability of that has gone from 1%, which is where the Reserve Bank was more than a month ago, to 15% probability. So this is a valid strategic option, right? I'm not saying it's the most likely, but it definitely is one to seriously consider. So 15% weighting. The next one is things can only get better. Here the rates cuts are even more profound, but the unemployment doesn't go down, it goes up. The mortgage stress goes higher, the bank losses are higher, and home prices effectively bubble up a little and then slide again. And then we're looking at 10 to 15% across the board, some much, much worse than that. Easing credit rules, fiscal stimulus, the whole soup nuts, everything is thrown at it. And there's about a 20% probability now of that happening. It was 10% last time, but now we've got all this activity. We've got the easing credit rules happening. We've got APRA changing some of the rules as well. So all of these things mean that these scenarios are now more valid than they were previously. The next one is the not yet doomsday. So this is now even a lower interest rate. Unemployment significantly higher. Mortgage stress way up. The bank losses higher. Home prices 20 to 30%. One bank probably needing a bailout. We gave that a 50% rating last time. It's dropped to a 25% rating this time. And that is because these other scenarios have now become more likely. simply because of what's happening with the recent policy changes. But also you'll see as we go on that the other more serious scenarios are now also coming into play, because we think that internationally, the international situation is looking pretty dodgy. Look at the US, look at China, look at Brexit, look at some of the other factors that are out there. I'm thinking of the Gulf as well. So essentially what this one, Armageddon, the Ireland 2.0, 20-25% down over 2 to 3 years. The bail-in and bail-out, and more QE and yet more QE. And then the last one, and this is the scary one, we now have upped the scenario of doomsday. So in other words, this whole thing just blows up on us, and we've moved it right up from 60% to 20%. And that is simply because the amount of uncertainty in the marketplace, locally and internationally, is significantly changed over the last month. Morgan Stanley put out a report in the last few days basically saying that the risks to the economy globally and locally are essentially really, really rising. We got the G20 ministers talking about the risks in the system and basically saying that we've got to do more stimulus to support it. So the complexity here is that really there are so many different scenarios now, and there's no one massively standing out. This is a big change from where I was previously. So I'm frankly saying we could see house prices a little up if in fact the Reserve Bank is successful in its strategies, or we could see prices crashing or somewhere in between. I'm sorry I can't be more definitive than that, but I think what this does is to just highlight to everybody that the level of uncertainty is now dramatic. It really is very dramatic. And what that basically means is that we have significant risks in the system, and it makes it very difficult to do policy. It makes it very difficult to know where to put your money, or indeed whether to buy or whether not to buy, because there is no one standout scenario now, unfortunately. That may change. We're getting more data in through our surveys, but that's where we are at the moment. And so I can't really sort of say for sure where the probability now lies, unfortunately. My own feeling is that we're probably somewhere between scenario 2 and scenario 3. I don't believe that there will be a significant hike in home prices over the next 2 or 3 years. There might be a little peak up, but then I think it'll come back, because I just don't believe that the amount of momentum is sufficient to reverse all of the poor lending and the mortgage fraud that we saw for a long time. So, you know, we'll have to just wait and see on that, I guess. But, you know, who knows? Okay. So that's essentially where we are. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to switch this back over here. And let's go and have a look at the live chat. Now, there's a lot of activity on the chat, and I've turned off a few people who've been making funny annoying comments, so apologies for those, but hopefully we're I'm just going to go back now and start looking for the at DFA, and we'll see what questions we have. There were quite a few that came in, I saw as I was talking, but I deliberately didn't pick them up. Okay, Joseph Wilkes, New Zealand data from RNZ not published. Auckland sales volumes at 1.2 to 2 billion bracket for the first 5 months of 2019 are 28% down on the first 5 months of 2018, with 3% foreign buyers. So, okay, so Joe is saying New Zealand is definitely wobbling as well. And, yeah, I think there are some interesting parallels between New Zealand and Australia. I think the New Zealand Reserve Bank is more en song with what's going on the Australian Reserve Bank, but there are still some significant issues. But, by the way, and regarding New Zealand, I have had data from the Southland to show that their prices are still on the way up. So it does, again, depend where you look. Averaging doesn't necessarily tell you all the answers, of course. Yep, as Richard says, BBSW is getting worse. It is, and my view is that the amount of stimulation that is now going on, the Reserve Bank is using repos. So what they're doing is basically putting liquidity in the marketplace. That means that effectively it's pushing interest rates down. So these market operations are essentially what the Reserve Bank is doing. They're going to do a lot more of that, because essentially what I think they're doing is trying to push the price of money down. if they push the price of money down, what they can then do is essentially, drive interest rates lower. And that's effectively the mechanism which is used to essentially control the interest rate. So, you know, somebody asked me earlier on, what happens? How does the Reserve Bank actually do this thing when they sort of say, well, rate's going to be X or Y, right? And the answer is, it's their market operations that actually drive it. So it isn't just saying, set the rates of that and, you know, and let the banks go and do it. They actually engineer this through their market operations, which is precisely what the Fed has been doing. Tends to expand the balance sheet of the Reserve Bank because they keep acquiring assets. And around the world, central banks are actually driving the volume of assets that they hold significantly up. So that's that one. Okay, what else have we got? Yeah. So somebody's saying there that inner Melbourne's not moved at all. There are some areas of Melbourne have, some areas haven't. So look at high rise. Some of the high rise around, particularly Docklands, looks a bit wobbly. Okay, so this is very good. Amrutha asks, is there any other house price index other than the CoreLogic and the ABS? Well, CoreLogic is certainly the main one. There are indices offered by realestate.com as well, but some of them, and even the ABS, tends to use the CoreLogic one. So the CoreLogic data is quite interesting because they publish this daily index. And there was an interesting phenomenon yesterday where actually every index from month, quarter and day were all down. Never seen that before. And then they have these other indices, which are the effectively longer term ones based on the settlements. The problem is that the data is 2 months old. Settlements take 6 to 8 weeks to come through because effectively when you pay for a property, sign on the dotted line, the legal stuff has to be done, money is finally transferred, and then it's settled and then recorded. So a lot of the data that we're seeing in the indices is out of date by a month or two, and that's part of the problem. We do not have in Australia a robust source of real price data, and the ABS bases some of their analysis on CoreLogic, which is pretty remarkable if you think about it. They used to do their own, but they don't anymore. So now the answer is there isn't, as far as I know, a definitively useful set of home price data. That's one of the things that we're struggling with in Australia at the moment. Okay, who else is... Let's have a look. A lot of conversations there, some of which I won't have time to get into now. Metals Crypto, I'm hoping for a doomsday scenario. Well, there you go. you can see there that my scenarios are quite evenly spread now. And, you know, it is tough to call at the moment, so we'll see how it... goes through. Now, Hercules says, can you talk about the New South Wales budget? Just briefly, yeah, and also South Australia. Both published budgets today, and both reported a collapse in GST, a collapse in stamp duties, and effectively a tightening of their budgets as a result of it. So most of the states have benefited it from the years and years of property price growth and the stamp duty and everything else that's actually come off the back of it. But now that's all changing because effectively sales momentum is way off and the foreign buyers are not active. And, you know, there's a bunch of reasons why that is. So effectively, suddenly the budgets are under pressure at a time when, if you look at the broader economy and the fact that the broader economy is easing and growth rates are really low, you would want to be stimulating the economies. You'd want to be putting more investment in. And here's the fundamental problem we have now. We have a federal government who doesn't want to run a deficit because they want to actually maintain a surplus. And yet we have an economy that's frankly close to the edge. On a per capita basis, it's a GDP recession. Household consumption was hardly supportive at all over the last time. And in fact, 80% of the growth in GDP, or 79%, was due to government spending. And that included infrastructure investment, it included NDIS, and it included Centrelink payments and those things. So we're in the situation where our economy is being supported by government spending, firstly, and then secondly, the massively high prices of iron ore, which mostly is going to China, And that's because Brazil basically still has these production problems. But we are very, very exposed. If China stops buying the raw materials from us because their economy begins to wobble, we're going to be in serious difficulty. And of course, because of the fact that interest rates are being cut and the broader momentum is easing, exchange rates dropping, so it's down to 68 point something now. And now a number of people are calling the rate going to go down to about 65. So at 65, we'll be inflating locally because we'll be importing inflation. Oil prices will rise. And it's interesting that the Reserve Bank, in their recent comments, actually said a rise in the oil price will be good because it would help inflation, which to me is absolutely nuts, because I know how many households are struggling with their budgets at the moment based on my surveys. And the last thing that they can cope with is rising oil prices. So it's a real big issue. So back to New South Wales and South Australia, they've got real issues now. They're going to have to downsize. They'll probably have to lay some people off, so more unemployment potentially. South Australia announced, I think, 1,500 redundancies from the public sector, mostly in administrative roles. Expect to see more of that ahead. Because essentially we're now in the situation where trying to actually manage the business of managing a state where income is going down, costs are rising, is very tricky. Now, Indiana Jones says, all the retail spaces below apartments in Sydney are empty. Yep, I agree there. This is one of those really interesting situations because the retail sector is in recession. In fact, the NAB published a report, their monthly report, and one of the things they said was that retail is, in their view, in recession. We think that's true from our SME surveys. We're seeing a lot of retail now saying we just can't keep this going because essentially there's not enough turnover coming through. Households are not spending with us, particularly discretionary type stuff. So people are still spending money on food and other things they have to take. But some of the discretionary spending is definitely coming off. Even some of the big ticket items, furniture and those sorts of things are coming off too. So many retail areas are struggling. Now, a lot of these high-rise apartments are based on ground floor retail, high-rise above. And of course, they're basing their economics on being able to let those retail spaces and use that to help pay for the overall running of the particular site. So if the retail spaces are free, it means that the owners of the building are effectively now running on empty when it comes to some of the revenue streams that they were expecting. So that's another reason why we are seeing more difficulty in the whole question of retail and high-rise. Hi, it's Liz Interruption. But if you're getting value from this post and have not done so, please consider subscribing to this channel or ring the bell for custom alerts. Plus, please consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or subscribe via Patreon for as little as $3 US a month or more to get access to exclusive additional content. Alternatively, you can also donate using Bitcoin. Here is the QR code. The links are in the comments below. I really appreciate your support, which enables us to continue to make more great content. Thanks very much. Now, back to the current show. Yeah, Ian says 45% of ARB again on her. Yeah, absolutely. But I didn't want to come out with that answer. I mean, I really hoped that I could see a way through without going into, gloom land. But I have to say that the US is likely to cut rates, not this month, but probably next month, and we'll cut again. We've got the trade wars going on with China. We've got the whole Brexit scenario just going around in ever-decreasing circles, and I don't think a new prime minister in the UK is going to make any difference at all. We've got the issues in Hong Kong. We've got China. The data out of China is looking pretty wobbly. And we also know that in the US itself, there's a greater probability now of a recession than previously, and I reported this at the weekend in the Property Imperative. There are experts in the US saying there's now a higher probability of a recession. We've got the negative, we've got the inverted yield curves. We had that for some time. But effectively now it looks as though the chances are that the US will go into recession. If they do, then that basically just has a further dampener on the economic situation. So all around the world, what's happening now is that central banks are dropping interest rates, doing more quantitative easing, effectively unwinding the tightening that they tried to do. And what they're doing is kicking the can down the road, building up the debt even more so. But it doesn't solve anything. All we're doing is just building a bigger pile of debt for later. And at some point, that's all going to come home to roost, which is why I'm unfortunately more negative about the situation than I was 2 or 3 months ago. Okay, what else have we got? Yeah, Jeff says, I fear an increase in suicide rates is a leading indicator, one to watch. I agree. You may have seen Eddie Hobbs. John Adams and I did an interview with Eddie recently. I did one with him previously. He's the guy over in Ireland who basically was on the curve before Ireland collapsed. And one of the things he kept pushing on, and I think rightly so, were the social implications and social consequences of all the things that are happening. Because effectively it is the fact that people get into difficulty, and as the difficulty rises, then the social pressures rise, and that can lead to, you know, all sorts of social consequences, including suicide. And I remember when I was talking to Eddie on the line over to Ireland, he said, you know, it's really scary when you actually talk to a number of people and you see similar behaviours, all of which are very, very worrying. So I'm afraid that this is some, you know, a really, really big deal. And the fact of the matter, I think, is that we're going to see a lot of social consequences and implications of this, unfortunately. I know from my household surveys, the 1 million households in mortgage stress, they're all basically saying the same thing, which is, it's really tough. It's really tough to try and manage a household budget when the cost of livings are continually rising, when incomes in real terms are not rising. Most households have seen no rise in income for 5, 6, 7 years now. The mortgages are really big. And, you know, there's a little bit of latitude potentially if rates are cut and that flows through. But actually, the chances are it's not going to be a huge amount, you know, 25 basis points or whatever or less. This is a really big deal, unfortunately. And I have a feeling that we're going to see more households just saying it's going to be harder and harder. And I think I mentioned previously that the Western Australian scenario is very interesting, because I've been tracking the stress in Western Australia for 5 or 6 years as it's developed, with incomes dropping significantly, with prices dropping in some cases 35%, with negative equity rising, with people who had investment properties that they can't let. And we're now in the situation where, for many people, the only thing they can do is essentially try and sell the property at a loss or effectively get foreclosed. And that is the scenario that I fear could spread more broadly. I hope it doesn't, but I am concerned that we seem to be following Western Australia. And the problem I see is we don't really have an economy that's got an alternative growth strategy, which means essentially it's you know, resources or nothing. And by the way, I also think that the drought and the consequences of the drought are being understated in terms of their impact on the economy. We know that the agricultural sector is significantly struggling in Victoria and New South Wales. And I think the ongoing consequences of that will also play out. Okay. Okay, here's a question from Vaibhav, I think that's right. Sorry if I haven't got your pronunciation right. I'm no statistician. Is your household sample big enough? Yeah. So basically, what's the error rate? Yeah. So 52,000 households, right? Now, there are about 10 million, give or take, just under that. So this is a 0.5% statistically optimized sample. And we have an error rate of about 2% on it. We've been running it for about 15 years now. And it's proved to be quite accurate so far. We have a number of clients around the world who take the data and use it. So it is statistically significant and appropriate for the size of the population that we're dealing with. It's optimized to the ABS sample survey using effectively census data. So we actually mirror the census distribution. And we also check it in terms of age, income, and some other characteristics, and it's proved to be statistically robust. So, yep, I'm pretty confident that it does the job. Yes. So one Burgo 7 says, need some helicopter money. Well, that's very interesting, right? So there's now a big debate going on. What should we do? Should we actually start handing money out directly, you know, a bit like we did post the GFC? Now, the question is, was that a good strategy? A lot of that money probably went to waste. It probably wasn't that well spent. But frankly, it might be a better option than actually just more interest rate cuts or quantitative easing. And of course, there is the MMT school that basically says we need to run the deficit because of basically a government isn't the same as a household. It is capable of running a deficit for an extended period of time. That money could actually then be used to invest in building more infrastructure, in potentially employing people who want jobs, and even paying, you know, a minimum wage if that's what people wanted to do. So there are some people who are arguing that the MMT approach is where we have to get to. Now, of course, you know, the current incumbents in the in government saying we don't want to run a deficit, so that's an interesting thing. But in the US, Bernie Sanders, for example, is advocating an MMT type strategy, and there are other players around the world who are all arguing the same thing, that essentially at this time in the cycle the only thing that we can do is to increase debt. Now, the problem with debt is it has to be paid back, and that's the problem that I have with MMT. I think the theory is interesting, but the consequences in terms of the debt that's there and how it's serviced becomes an interesting challenge. Of course, interest rates will stay low for a long, long time. And what that means is that effectively the cost of the debt could be relatively constrained, but the implications of running huge deficits for a long period of time, well, have they worked? If you look around the world, there are many economies with very big deficits who are still struggling. And it's worth reflecting on Japan, who's basically gone through a very long sort of down cycle and frankly are in the situation where the economy in Japan is on one level looking okay, but if you look below the surface, there are lots of issues, very little property growth, very little economic growth in some respects, and of course the demographic shift they've got there. So there's really no simple answer, and that's, I guess, one of the challenges, right? There is no simple way out from where we are. We've boxed ourselves into a corner because of the dumb strategies that we used post 2007-08 with quantitative easing. Central banks have got into their head that they can control all of this and manage all the variables, and so what they do is to try and manage ahead of a crisis rather than bringing on a crisis. And there was an interesting discussion that John and I did some time ago as to, you know, is it really sensible to try and keep this bubble going along and just quantitative ease more and more and more? Or is it more sensible to effectively recognize there has to be a correction, let the correction happen, and then basically rebuild a cleansing, if you like? And there are a number of economists out there who believe that a cleansing is the only way to go. There are others who fundamentally believe that the central bank strategy around quantitative easing is the right way to go. Tough. There is no simple, right, straightforward answer, I'm afraid. Okay. There is no try. Do you think the federal government will stick with their focus on surplus when the time counts? They may have to make a call. I think that's right. I think it's quite likely that at some point down the track, when the economy becomes even more troublesome, that they'll probably have to change their tune. But they're not there yet, and they're still holding to their promise of a surplus. But if you look at the assumptions in their budgets, in terms of growth, in terms of employment, in terms of interest rates, they're all way off now compared with where we are. So I suspect that if they ran a budget calculation now, they'd already be in deficit. That's my own view. Okay. What else have we got? QE is the stupidest policy ever, says Ben. I tend to agree. It's central bank groupthink, frankly. They've talked themselves into believing that this is how they should be doing it, right? So let's inflate the size of central banks' balance sheets. Let's empower them to do yet more and yet more. And in fact, it's interesting that the debate going on in the US at the moment is whether QE is working at all. There's a big review going on as to what the central bank's role should be and whether QE is a good thing or not, right? And there are lots of papers coming out saying, actually, QE has not solved anything, right? We've inflated debt. We've given cheap money to corporates so that they can actually buy back their shares and lift their share price. So we see asset inflation, house price inflation, but there's little investment in productive business, and therefore, you know, is this really a strategy that's going to work? Possibly not. So I tend to agree with your assessment there. So that's an interesting comment from Harry that says, how do you see your future mortgage being paid off? Debt handed over to kids? It's an interesting question, right? So there are multi-generational mortgages in some countries. There are also mortgages with negative interest rates, like in Denmark, for example, just come out because they've got quantitative easing there. But there's an interesting question, right? Do you have to get to the point where the amount of debt that you have is effectively impossible to repay? And do you just say, OK, I'm just going to continue to pony up and continue to pay interest on my debt for the whole of my life, and, you know, the next generation can sort it out? There are people in my surveys who actually believe that that is the right way to do it. So, you know, they're sort of saying, you're stupid not to take big amounts of debt because it's so cheap. You know, if you can service it, then have the lifestyle that that debt enables you and let somebody else clean up the mess. I'm afraid that's a strategy that I can't agree with. But there are many people who actually think that's the way to do it. And of course, interesting debate. If you have debt when you effectively come to the end of your natural, what happens to it? Does it go to the estate? If there's no survivors, does the debt get written off? Interesting question. Okay, Jeff has asked about Deutsche Bank, and I've done several posts on Deutsche Bank over the last little while. And the thing about Deutsche Bank is that we know that they've got massive exposures in derivatives. We know that they've got real problems with the profitability of their bank. What they've announced recently is they're going to create a bad bank and put all the US trading stuff into that, including, I think, a lot of derivatives. And they'll put that over there as a separate entity. And the rest of the bank, they will focus on effectively looking at funding their bank by deposits. But the risks from Deutsche Bank are huge. And I still think there are some significant risks, although I suspect that the share of Deutsche Bank that is actually the, if you like, the good bank, would be supported by Germany. But the bad bank, the bank with all of those risk assets in, 50 billion, is a big number, and there's a lot of risk attached to it. And the question there is, what is the true value? Because that's effectively the mark-to-market value. That isn't the true value of the risks if things go wrong. So yeah, watch that. It'll be very, very interesting to see. Now, at Wiser 3754, so firstly, you get your own today. Thank you very much. Appreciated. Why are countries such as Russia and China buying gold en masse? Okay. They are, and they have been, and there are other people buying up gold around the world as too. And it's because of the fact that we think, quite likely, at some point in the future, the US dollar will cease to be essentially the cornerstone of the financial system. Today, the US dollar is seen as the best currency to hold, the most firm, the most stable. But what happens if that down the track, that isn't the case? What happens if other players, backed by perhaps gold, is able to assert their own power of their own currency? And effectively, the power of the US dollar dissipates. That's what this is about. So effectively, people in some of these other countries are buying massive amounts of gold. We wonder of where that gold is coming from. You know, John Adams and his Australian gold, you know, who's got it? Well, watch some of our earlier videos if you want to know more about that. The fact of the matter is that gold is being collected by some investment banks, by a number of powers internationally, as well as individuals. And a lot of people see gold as essentially a much more secure hold compared with other currencies that, you know, you don't know quite what they're doing. My point is simply this. Gold is just as much at risk of market manipulation as all of the other currencies. In fact, we know that the gold price is artificially managed and manipulated at the moment. So don't assume that gold is this silver bullet, if you pardon the pun, because essentially the dynamics of the gold are quite similar to many other commodities. And also for Bitcoin on the same sort of category. People are also saying, well, maybe we should grasp Bitcoin because nobody's controlling that. Well, maybe, but there are massive risks in the Bitcoin world as well, with exchanges that people are not quite sure who owns them, if anybody owns them. We've had exchanges hacked. We've got massive run-ups in the value of Bitcoin. There is no fundamental underlying for Bitcoin, so it's basically just a sentiment question. So gold and Bitcoin, which are those two cornerstones of alternative risk strategies that many people think about using, both of those are actually quite risky in their own right for different reasons. So don't think of them as safe havens. There are no safe havens, unfortunately. There is risk everywhere, whether you look at deposits, whether you look at the stock markets, whether you look at gold, whether you look at Bitcoin, whether you look at bonds. All the asset classes have risks attached to them. And the question then is to try and calibrate the relative risks of those different asset classes. And that will be determined by your own view in terms of what you think the scenarios are going to be and how they're going to play out. Because if you think we're going to go towards Armageddon, you might go one way. Whereas if you think we're more likely to follow the Reserve Bank strategy, you might go a different way. And the other point to make, of course, is that these various dynamics in the marketplace and, you know, how these plays out, they keep changing, right? Because effectively we see more central bank intervention, we see more international crises coming up. So the problem is that there is little certainty out there other than a whole bunch of uncertainty. So my own view is expect the unexpected and spread your risks. Okay, that's that one. Let me go back to the, see what else is coming there. Degor asked, yes, he agrees with me. Thank you. Yes, all assets have innate risks. That's the point. And in fact, many people don't understand that even deposits have risks, right? Because a deposit is effectively an unsecured loan that you make to the bank on the expectation that you're going to potentially get it back. We can talk about bail-in if you want to, I think. J88 asks about Iran. So do you think the US is deliberately trying to keep oil high to help prop up the US dollar? It's difficult to know what's really going on there because, of course, there's a lot of fog in the messaging. My own view is that Iran is, of course, under huge pressure from the US because of the sanctions that they've applied. And Iran is certainly not incapable of using oil as a weapon to essentially try and put pressure back on the West. So my suspicion is, and I've got no data to prove this, but I can certainly argue it logically, my suspicion could be that maybe Iran created the incident with a deliberate intent to try and slow the flow of oil to effectively apply pressure back into the US. Now, of course, there's some flaws with that argument. The first is that the US has a lot of production now onshore because of all the shale and the fracking that they've done. And the second is that the demand for oil in the US is significantly down. So the most recent statistics that came out showed that the stocks in the US are very high in terms of oil. So it may not necessarily impact the US, but it could certainly impact other countries. And by the way, you know, it's worth reflecting on how many weeks' supply of oil do we have in Australia? Because we don't refine now in Australia. We are completely dependent on importing oil consistently. And the latest statistics that I saw was it could be 3 weeks or so. So if there was a massive international issue with oil supply, we've got about 3 weeks to sort it out. It's not very long. Okay, let's see what else we've got there. This is from Josh. Doesn't the Japan-USA example, the fact that it's been going on for so long, basically prove that MMT is a viable option? The sky hasn't fallen in Japan and the US? Yeah, maybe. Yeah, you could argue that. But if you look at the debt in both the countries, both in Japan and in the USA, they've got massive amounts of debt. And they've got no means to unwind that debt at the moment. So it goes back to the question, is debt ultimately something which a country can continue to inflate forever? Or is there going to be a day of reckoning? At some point, does their currency effectively suddenly get trashed? That's really the key question. We haven't got there yet, but it'll be interesting to see how this plays out. I think it's too soon to say whether MMT is or isn't a valid solution. I certainly think we need to debate about MMT, and I think we need to have a balanced debate, because basically you tend to get polarization. In fact, we've seen this on the DFA blog, right? We put up a post with John Adams discussing some of the negative parts of MMT, and we got a whole bunch of people saying, well, no, MMT's great. And then we did an interview with an MMT exponent from Adelaide University, and we got a whole bunch of people saying MMT's rubbish and how could you have him on the channel. Really interesting that this is a really polarized debate. What I'm trying to do here and in, on DFA is to have some debates around some of these issues and try and get some of these things really explored, because I think it's important that we have some opinions that are informed opinions rather than just ideological. Okay, this is from Theo. What's your thoughts on holding large parcels of land? There is no more being made. That is true to an extent, but Australia is a huge country, right? We've had massive land constriction. If you look at what's happened over the last 50 to 80 years, land prices have been driven up because effectively the planning processes have been deliberately constrained. And what we're now seeing is some releasing of land parcels around the edge of towns. But if you look in Western Sydney, land prices have dropped by 50% in the last year. And that shows you that certainly over the cycle, land prices can drop down. And if you talk to Edwin Almeida, who's been on the channel a few times, he will tell you that, you know, some of these high-rise buildings and everything else, you come back to what is the value of the land fundamentally. So in the long term, assuming that the world population continues to grow, chances are if you're holding physical land, it's worth something, but I'm not sure exactly what it's worth and how will the drought play out and, you know, all of those things. In some countries, of course, population is reducing. And we know that, for example, in Japan, they're really struggling with population growth, and in other countries too. So it's, you know, not necessarily a laid down mazir. What I will say, though, of course, is that people will, and they keep telling me this, at least with land, I can see it, I can hold it, I can walk it. And you know, that's true, at least you can see it. But it's difficult to know for sure how this is going to play out. And of course, there are many people and many firms and companies who have land banked lots of land. So they bought it years ago and are just sitting on it waiting for the next price spike to then sell it. So you are competing with a bunch of other people too. Okay, so somebody is just saying, you know, 5 to 10% of precious metals in a portfolio. That's from DIY. Yep, I think diversification is good. My own strategy is not to go into precious metals because I believe that they are too uncertain and the value is too unknown. Other people will disagree with me. There are people on the channel who believe that precious metals is, you know, is the way to go, and good on them. I have a different view, but you know, as with all of these things, who knows? Okay, what else are we doing? Cookie Boy makes the point, and I think I covered it, that the US doesn't need to import oil internationally. That's correct, because of all of their shale activities. They've got enough onshore oil in the US for at least 20 to 25 years. So effectively, they are less directly exposed to what's happening in the Middle East. But of course, they are a huge political player in the Middle East and what's going on there. And I suspect, again, the risk is collateral damage, right? There are other countries much less able to produce oil for themselves who are absolutely at the mercy of the oil producers. Okay, Genevieve says, if the RBA is effectively carrying out QE, doesn't it need to be made public, i.e. public interest? What are the journos scared of? I don't think many of the journos understand what's really going on, frankly. There are very few who really take the time to delve into the internal workings of the RBA's balance sheet. Also, the amount of information that's publicly available is very low. They do report on a weekly basis the various balances on the RBA, but there is very little information about their market operations. So I think it's deliberate to keep it relatively under wraps. But, you know, my view is QE is already happening. And I've had a conversation with a number of journalists where I've gone through the arguments and shown them the data, and they basically shrug their shoulders and say, that's too complicated, there's not a story in it. And I'm thinking, wow, well, that's interesting. So I will continue to try and monitor this. I'm building some new models to try and assess the quantum of quantitative easing that's going on at the moment. And when I've got those models working, I'll report them on the DFA channel. So keep an eye, and you might learn more soon. But you're right, the journos, and look, the financial sector journos in Australia are far between now. You know, there aren't many of them. Most of them are actually, you know, within the large papers, and frankly, they don't have a lot of time to get into any detail. Most of them come and tapping on my door, and like the AFR, for example, the number of times that the AFR taps on my door for information, pick my brains. It's pretty remarkable, actually. I had 7:30 call me this evening on another story. So it tends to be quite a few people tapping a rather few sources of knowledge at the moment. And a lot of the economists who sit within the major banks are good in some respects, but they're myopic in others. I'm not sure that they've picked up this QE thing yet either. Okay. So somebody's suggesting I should interview Scott Pape. We'll see. I've got a few interviews planned with various luminaries down the track, but they're quite hard to tie down. Okay, there's one here. Yeah, Michael makes the point. That's a good point, actually. Shale oil creates demand for US dollars. It does. That's a very good point. Thank you for that. Okay. Why are we seeing the shift on sentiment for RMBS post the election? Isn't it too soon to assume house prices stabilised? Yep. Well, house price stabilisation. I don't believe that house prices have stabilised. There's a little bit of sideways movement, but we'll see. The thing about the RMBS, though, is that that is one of the tools of quantitative easing, right? Basically, those could be bought by the Reserve Bank. In other words, they can be converted to cash. So it is part of the QE kit bag. And if you look at what happened in the US and in the UK, a lot of the QE was done through the buying of bonds and also using repos, which is effectively another bond type of transaction. So I think that's part of the story. We don't know the full story yet on this, I must tell you. There's a lot more to come out, I think. So A. Hitwell says, what do you see as a stable place to put your money in an Armageddon situation? You've mentioned banks as unsecured, metals, land. Is anywhere safe? No, not really. I mean, the argument goes, buy a safe. A lot of people in Japan have bought safes. You know, but it depends. What are you trying to achieve? If it's about the physical security of assets, that's one thing. If it's trying to maintain a revenue stream or income, that's a different question. Or if it's, you know, pure survival, that's a question again. We are in a situation where there are so many uncertainties, it is very, very difficult to know how to jump at the moment. Now, we have a deposit scheme in Australia, right, which basically says that deposit up to a certain amount, $250,000, in a bank is secure in the case of a bank collapse. Trouble is, there's only a limited amount of that security which is available, and it's not activated yet. It will only be activated if the government deems it to be activated. So it's a theoretical security. It's not an actual security, right? We also have the situation with deposits where before a bank fails, there is a risk that those deposits could be bailed in. And again, we've discussed this before. The thing about bail-in is it's unclear in Australia. There is forceful influence from the IMF and elsewhere that bail-in should be more explicit in Australia. There is a bit of a pushback from other people as well. It's not clear. In New Zealand, it's totally clear. Deposits in New Zealand are available for bail-in. In other words, they can be converted to equity to stop a bank failing. And in that situation, a bank, if it were to bail in and survive wouldn't then need to be activate the deposit insurance. So those two things are, you know, pulling in two different directions. So banks and bank deposits are a bit questioning. I mean, particularly I think those with derivatives exposures and large exposures. My own view has been to spread the risks to some of the smaller players who are less exposed to derivatives and who have more of their funding effectively tied directly to deposits. That's been my own strategy for the moment. Then, of course, you can think about offshore, you know, US, take positions on the US dollar and those things. People have done that. And, of course, if the US moves differentially to Australia, you might benefit or might not. Some people have tried that. Some people have also looked at bonds. And the thing about bonds is that they may well pay a particular coupon, which may be good, maybe not. But there are some risks attached to bonds too. And in fact, pretty much any particular investment vehicle that you think of has got risks attached to it. The trouble is most investors really don't understand the risk they're getting into. And very often, you know, the publicity around a particular investment, the claimed returns may not actually come true. So, yeah, this is a highly risky situation. And it really is now, we're in the situation where it is tough to see how to protect financial assets. That's the truth of the matter. Cookie Boy says, Martin, what are your views on trade wars between China and the USA? I believe Trump is going to do a number on China like Reagan did on Gorbachev in the 80s. Well, I think my own view is that China is probably more under the pump relative to the US at the moment. And therefore, we are going to see significant pressure coming from the US. You know, Trump has basically said he pulled back from a deal because the fact that he couldn't get what he wanted, and that may or may not be true. I know that they're trying to do a lot to do with intellectual capital and intellectual property because they think that's a big deal. And I think that Trump thinks that he can just play hardball for longer than China can. And we know in the latest data that came out of China over the weekend that they are actually showing signs of stress now, particularly in their commercial sector. They've actually started to stimulate their housing sector significantly. They are trying to sell more steel to other countries around the world to basically offset some of the losses that are being created by the trade dispute. My own view is that this is going to go on for some more months because essentially Trump can afford to let this run certainly until next year. There's a presidential election at some point which will probably overtake events, but he's got several months to play with. I suspect that China will find this more and more difficult. And remember that their economy is slowing already. It was already. The growth rates are dropping. And, you know, big debate about whether the growth rates as reported are accurate or not, but that's another story. But the fact of the matter is that this trade war is going to spill out and is going to have significant impact on our own economy and other economies around the world. And so the collateral damage that is being done because of it is pretty dramatic. That's one of the reasons why I've gone more negative on my scenarios, because I think that the you know, if you like, the sort of the pendulum towards midnight in terms of the Armageddon is closer now because of it. So it's really tricky, but I think that the US is probably thinking that they can sit this out longer than China can at the moment. So it's going to be a bit of a waiting game, I think. Okay. Let's have a look. Just reading a few of the things that we won't be showing tonight. There's always a few, aren't there? Okay. What's your view of the ASX 300 post QE? This is from J88. I think that QE inflates assets, and it definitely will inflate stock prices. One of the reasons why the US is having difficulty is they tried to basically reverse QE through the last quarter of last year. And the stock market started to drop significantly because they suddenly realised that the magic pudding basically had stopped working. But the market power was so strong that effectively the Reserve Bank in the US, the Fed, basically had to reverse course. And the problem that I see is that the power of the markets to dictate to the central banks, just keep going, keep inflating asset prices so that we can do more share buybacks and all those things, is very, very strong. So, yeah, it's quite likely that the stock markets will continue to thrive and will continue to go higher until we get a major correction. And at some point, you remember that post 2007-08, there was a significant correction. There have been a few significant corrections through the years. But yeah, I think QE will actually inflate stock prices. It may well inflate property prices to an extent, although for the reasons we discussed earlier on, probably not as much as perhaps some people are saying. So it's a big deal, I think. But yeah, expected to go higher. Megan's thanking me for speaking truth. Well, you know, it's my opinion, right? I could be totally wrong, but I study this stuff pretty much all the time, and I think that my understanding of what's really going on is actually relatively sophisticated. I also am always happy to learn from other people, so I learn from a lot from the guests on the channel and also the comments as well. I do read a lot of the comments. In fact, I read them all. I don't necessarily comment on all the comments because that would take forever. But, hopefully here you get a bit of balance, but also hopefully some thoughts as to, you know, some of the things that are really important. Clive says, how much thought have you given to putting literal cash in a bank safe deposit box? Yeah, people have done that. And then the question is that deposit box essentially safe? Now, in some countries, there have been stories where deposit box were grabbed as part of a bank collapse. In theory, the bank deposit box should only be a storage facility and the bank should have no lien or right to any of the contents of the box. In practice, not always convinced that actually works. Certainly couldn't bail in money there. So, you know, there are people who actually are storing physical cash. And by the way, in a number of countries, people are removing large notes out of circulation. There's a debate going on in the UK about the £100 note. I expect to see similar things here later. We are seeing a migration toward digital cash. There's a reason for that, and it's not just to simplify transactions. It's more easier to control. And I wouldn't be surprised to see large notes just disappearing out of circulation. It's all part of trying to keep more control on what's going on. One of the things that quite often happens prior to a crisis is that there are limits placed on how much you can withdraw from your bank account via the ATM or even if you go into the branch. It's an interesting question. If you go into a branch today and you've got money in your bank account, how much could you get out in one hit without prior notice? You may be surprised that it's a lot lower than you might think. Harold says, back to Oz, the papers are reporting pressure on apartment settlement risk and developers trying to avoid reducing prices and defects. Surely this market couldn't play. Yeah, it's already happening. So we've already done a post on the issues around Opal Tower and now Mascot Tower. The quality of construction is abysmal. A lot of the stuff that's been built recently is cheap, internationally imported materials, including containing asbestos. The quality of the construction is pretty bad. A lot of people bought off the plans and now they're realizing that they're valued much lower than they were previously. There was heavy discounting going on up until the election and the rate cut. Some developers have now stopped discounting. Others are still doing it. And, you know, if you look around Sydney, you'll discover that there are quite a few people offering 12 months free mortgage for people to buy. So they're trying to incentivize people to buy. And there's a very interesting article on the ABS site, on the ABC site, which I helped to provide information for, where they discuss all of the issues around this. Yeah, this is a big deal. buying off the plan, then not wanting to commit, not able to commit to complete, not being able to get the mortgage that you thought you could get because the value of the property has dropped, not wanting to complete because the value of the property has dropped, or you bought and now you find that your property is worth 30% less than you thought it was. Look at North Ryde as an example. These are big falls. And there are many people now in relatively newly constructed high-rise apartments worrying about whether, in fact, they've got similar construction issues, cracks, those sorts of things. Remember that the Mascot Tower was 10 years old. Remember that the Opal Tower was much more recent. So we have a very significant set of risks around high-rise construction. But as Edwin made the point on one of our recent shows, it's not just high-rise. Even low-rise construction is actually pretty shoddy. The self-certification processes that are being used are pretty shoddy, and you cannot guarantee that the quality of construction has followed the building standards to the letter, and therefore there are considerable risks potentially around this whole situation. That's one of the reasons why I'm calling for the falls, particularly in the unit high-rise areas, particularly in the urban fringes around our major CBD areas, where there's been massive high-rise construction. No demand now from international investors, less demand from local occupiers. Frankly, if I was wanting to buy an apartment, I'd go for an older style apartment on an older block rather than one that's been built in the last 10 years or so. Just my personal opinion, but, you know, it's really quite concerning what is going on. Okay. There's an interesting question there. Whoops. Just going to look at that. Harry Dent recommended putting cash in a brokerage account in your own name. Can you elaborate? Yep. This is from Germander. So basically, Harry was arguing that what you should do is not put your money into a bank that effectively is exposed to trading, derivatives, or any of that, right? What you want is an entity that basically is just a holder of an account. They don't do any trading on their own right. And in the US, there are a number of brokerage firms who offer that. Now, the question is, are there any in Australia? And the answer is, I haven't found any yet. Now, some people may have a view, and if they are, then, you know, add a comment. The fact of the matter is that the whole question of, you know, where to put your money is complicated. And, you know, brokerage accounts may be one option. The idea is that they are less exposed to these trading risks, derivatives risks, and the other things, and, you know, that we've been talking about. So that's why. But it is tricky in Australia to find one. Okay, let's have a look. What's that one? Today, this is from Something Piston. Hello. There you go. You got your today. Thank you very much for that. Really appreciate it. Okay, what's the time? 9:23. Okay, we're running out of time. Well, I failed to get to any of my questions that people sent in beforehand. So what I'm going to do is I'll do a separate offline post and answer those questions. I've got a couple of pages worth, although some of them I have covered. I'm just going to see. Okay, this is from Daryl. At some stage, everyone needs to address the plan the IMF laid out in its blog on extreme NIRP, which is the negative interest rate policies. Yep. The fact of the matter is that negative interest rate strategies are fraught with risk. It's an experiment. It's an unproven experiment. It might give us a little bit of wriggle room for a few months or years, but it doesn't fundamentally solve the economic crisis that we have around the world. It just basically creates an alternative version of it. And, you know, the IMF, the World Bank, the BIS, those organizations are all sort of talking about some of the risks involved in some of these things. And what I'm interested to see is that there is actually now a bit of a swell that maybe this is not good strategy, that basically there are some risks to zero interest rate and beyond strategies that people haven't yet fully understood, and that the zero bounds is real, despite the fact that a lot of spruikers out there are still saying, yeah, do QE, take interest rates negative, not a problem. I mentioned Denmark earlier on. In Denmark, there is a mortgage where they pay you to take the mortgage because they're just desperate to lend. It's remarkable. To my mind, it just shows that this whole thing needs a different way of thinking. All right. This is from Cine Tech Geek. What future info announcement in the next few weeks, months, will give us more clarity on your estimates? Unemployment figures? When can we expect them? Yeah, good question. Okay, so I've got my next household survey data coming through at the end of June. And I've asked some very specific questions about price expectations and some other things too. So I will get my private data, which I'll share with you in the next month, as to what households are really thinking. That will tell me whether, in fact, there is likely to be a considerable increase in demand for property. So that's the first. Secondly, yeah, we need to be following employment quite closely, because the employment rate, if it does start to tick up, it's 5.2 at the moment. If it goes up towards 5.5, despite the fact the Reserve Bank wants to get to 4.5, we know we've got a real problem. But of course, the employment rate as reported is not the real employment rate. The true employment rate is a lot higher than that, as some others report. So we know we've got more employment, and therefore we haven't got full employment. Therefore, wage growth is probably not going to happen anytime soon. And that's the other thing I'd be looking at. If we started seeing a significant uptick in wage growth, maybe we could claim that we could turn a corner. The other thing that I think we need to watch quite closely is the iron ore price, because the iron ore price is fundamentally critical to our trade balance. And if that drops back, so if Brazil starts producing, or if China starts laying off the importing of iron ore, that could be a very significant leading indicator. And the one I also think personally is really important is this underemployment number. The underemployment number, of course, is trying to get at people who haven't got the work they'd like. It's a very high number, as I showed you earlier on. It's bigger than where we were in the GFC. So there are a lot of people want work, can't get work. If we start seeing that rising, I shall also be thinking that that will be a leading indicator. And then the other one I think it's worth just reflecting on is the household savings ratio. So that has gone down quite a long way. It's come just a little bit higher because people are getting nervous, so they're putting more into savings. So it'll be interesting to see what that does, because that's a level of indication as to whether people can save and or whether they're actually under cash flow constraints. And if they are under cash flow constraints, what that essentially means is that they're unable to manage the realities of their budgets. So those are some of the things I'll be looking at. And then the other one, the one I come back to, is this credit impulse, or the rate of change of credit. If we start seeing credit increasing significantly and maintaining its growth, that tells us we're going to have another, if you like, cycle of debt. We're going to actually get households into more debt first before this all goes wrong. So I'm going to be watching that closely. So there are three or four indicators. I report them every month in my various blogs posts. I also do a spot on Nuggets News, or you may have seen that. Shout out to Nugget. That's a really interesting channel. They focus mainly on Bitcoin, but they also do from time to time discuss the broader economic issues. And I'm on there pretty much once a month. Those are some of the leading indicators that I think are important. Give it 3 months. I've always said that by September we'll know exactly where this is going to play out. I'll be able to update my scenarios once again before we get to Christmas. Okay, let's just have a look. Roy Morgan has real underemployment at 10.3%. Thanks, good boy. Indeed, absolutely they do. And the Roy Morgan is not seasonally adjusted and other things, but it's a better measure in my view. And by the way, CPI is ridiculous as well. That's another story. Okay, so I think we're getting quite close to the end of the show. I'll just go one more look back through to see whether there are any other questions that I missed. Okay. So I think I've covered all of the main questions that we've got. I'm sorry I didn't get to the questions that were submitted beforehand. I will do a separate post like I did last month on those questions. I've got some quite interesting ones to cover off. We have covered a few of them in the chat tonight. But I guess I want to leave you with this sort of closing thought. We are at a critical inflection point with regard to the local economy and the global economy. The level of uncertainty in both is probably as high as I have ever seen it in my long career. I've been doing this for many, many years. I started way back in, you know, the late 70s, early 80s. So I've been following these cycles for a long time. The degree of disconnection and discontinuity in the financial markets, the amount of debt that's in the system, the amount of stupidity going on in terms of policy, both internationally and locally, and the lack of ability of our political class to really get stuff done for the benefit of the people, are all out of the scale, off the scale in my view, and I think that's disgraceful. So I'm afraid that we are in a situation where a lot needs to be thought about differently. So to the extent that DFA can help to inform and educate, that's what we try and do on this channel. We don't make watertight predictions because it is way too uncertain to do that. But at least you can get a bit of a flavour of some of the issues that are milling about. And, you know, what I end up by saying to people is, remember that life is more than money. You know, money is perhaps a means to an end for many people. But I actually think that the moral dimension and the social dimension here is really, really important, because at the end of the day, one of the reasons why I come back to do what I do is because I'm really interested in people and, you know, their situations and circumstances, not just in the financial markets and in the dynamics of economics, which is where a lot of people spend all of their time. So from that perspective, you'll get a different dimension here than perhaps you will do elsewhere. So I hope you found this a useful session. If there are specific questions that you'd like me to follow up, then feel free to pass those through to me. There will be more posts. There will be more guests. We've got a whole bunch of other things planned over the next little while. And Joe Wilkes has just said that for Kiwis, if you want data, go to interest.co.nz. Ignore the real estate spin and question the narrative. There are a few characters. Healthy debate, worth learning from some good minds. Thank you for that, Joe. Yep, we are still covering New Zealand, well, not particularly tonight, but Joe and I have been chatting about how we might actually extend our coverage further into New Zealand. So watch the space on that as well. So there we go. I think that's going to be the lot for tonight. So thank you very much for spending the time with me. It's been a privilege to spend some time with you. I hope that you've learnt something and perhaps had some fun along the way. I'm sorry that the news is not better, but you know, I'm merely here as reporting what I see. I will continue to do that on the DFA channel, and I look forward to seeing you on future posts. We'll be back in a month with another live stream. We'll be posting most days through DFA and also on the Interest of the People. Thanks for spending time with me tonight, and we'll see you next time. It's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics signing off. Thank you for your time today.